The views expressed on this program are those of the individual participants and not necessarily those of WVUD or the University of Delaware. Welcome to WVUD's Campus Voices, weekly conversations with interesting members of the university community, visitors to campus, and others engaged in thought-provoking research and community service. Stay tuned for Campus Voices on WVUD.
Okay, welcome to Campus Voices on 91.3 WVUD. I'm your host, Rich Campbell, and today we are talking to Professor McKay Jenkins of the University of Delaware's English Department. And you are the Cornelius Tillman Professor of English, Journalism, and Environmental Humanities. Today we are going to talk about one of most people's favorite topics, food. And your latest book is called Food Fight, GMOs, and the Future of the American Diet. Why don't we just give a real basic definition? People might think they know, but for those of us who haven't had a biology class in years, what exactly is a GMO?
GMO stands for a genetically modified organism. And really what we're talking about is the modification of plants. And as I'm sure we'll get into this later, people think that because we're talking about plants, because we're talking about the way that scientists can go into a plant genetic code and introduce snippets from a different organism and put it into a plant, that the way they must be eating GMOs is in the produce aisle. They think that, well, if we're talking about plants, then the only place I ever see plants in the supermarket is in the produce aisle, which is the very first and one of the biggest misunderstandings of GMOs, because, in fact, we are talking about plants, but we're not actually talking about produce. You know, where you find GMOs in the supermarket is pretty much anywhere except for the produce aisle. So you're not going to find GMO tomatoes. You're not going to find GMO cucumbers. You're not going to find GMO lettuce. What you are going to find is GMOs in all the aisles in the middle of the supermarket. So whether you're talking about junk food or processed food or soda or almost any of the meat that we eat, especially if it's really low-grade meat, especially things like fast food hamburgers or really cheap, inexpensive meat, you're going to find that all the animals that were fed that, whether they're cattle or pigs or chickens, were all fed GMOs. So really what we're talking about with GMOs is genetically altered plants that were genetically altered for a very specific reason. And in this country, really what we're talking about is corn and soybeans. But you take a couple hundred million acres of corn and soybeans and you can turn them into virtually any kind of food product. You can turn them into the processed packaged foods that we eat, but you can also feed them to animals. Americans, I think, eat about 9 billion animals a year. It's 9 billion with a B. So we're talking about, for example, on the Eastern Shore, we raise something like 570 million chickens. Those are virtually all fed GMO soybeans. If you're talking about the cattle that are used to make hamburgers for the fast food industry, they're all being fed GMO corn. If you're making soda pop, you're sweetening it with GMO high fructose corn syrup. So the GMOs that we're eating are absolutely everywhere, but they're not necessarily visible or obvious to us. They're not in the plants that we eat as plants. They're in the foods that we eat that are being processed with all these things.
So scientists are basically going in and altering DNA, RNA, genetic code to give plants certain traits. And from reading your book, things like resistance to pests or making crops stronger in drought conditions, those are some of the reasons why scientists are doing that, right?
Right. And it's really important for your listeners to understand that this book is not anti-GMO technology, really. The book is very neutral about GMO technology. GMO technology can be used for all kinds of things. It can be used, for example, to make food more nutritious, if you think about it. There are different projects in different parts of the world where they're using genetic engineering to create crops in Asia, for example, called golden rice, where you take a rice plant and you mess with its genome in such a way that you create a plant that now has beta carotene in it. So when you look at a rice grain, it's not white, it's orange, or they would say golden. And now if a person eats it, especially a young person, a child eats it, they will get beta carotene, which allows their body to produce vitamin A, which will mean that they will fend off juvenile blindness or even actually premature death, because vitamin A deficiency can be a killer for undernourished children. In Africa, they can use genetic engineering to make golden cassava, which is a root crop that doesn't have vitamin A in it unless you alter it. So genetic engineering can be used for really productive, very helpful projects. The thing is, in the United States, this technology is mainly being used, as I mentioned before, to create more and more high-calorie, low-nutrition food. So this is where things get complicated, because you will hear big global conglomerate food companies say that we need GMOs to feed the world. You'll hear that all the time, which is in a way a bit of sleight of hand or being disingenuous, because what they're using, what these companies are using GMO technology to do, is to create more unhealthy, high-calorie, low-nutrition food for American consumers. So it's not that GMO technology is causing problems. It's the use of technology to create and further this American diet, which is really an unsustainable for the environment and an unhealthy for our bodies way to eat. The GMO technology, as you mentioned, can be used in all kinds of ways to fight insects, to fight viruses and bacteria and fungus and all that sort of thing. But what we're talking about in this country, the way it enters our bodies, is really through eating poorly.
I notice your first chapter is titled, Are GMOs Safe? Is That the Right Question? I think most listeners would think, well, that's the real question, isn't it? Can I eat this stuff?
I think that chapter begins by saying something like, the only question anybody really wants to know is, are they safe? That's not the right question, because most scientists, and I'm talking about in the mid-90% of scientists that work on plant genetics and food safety, say that genetically altered plants are no more dangerous than eating regular plants. And that is really a tough thing to swallow for anti-GMO activists. They just don't believe that. And it may, of course, be true that someday we'll find out that eating a genetically altered plant somehow has some hidden dangers that we don't know about. But the state of science as it is now tells us that eating genetically altered plants is not any more dangerous for our health than eating a regular plant. And the people who say that are also correct in reminding us that all plants, every plant that we've ever, that any human has ever eaten, has its own defense mechanism. So plants have natural insecticides, they have natural virus resistance, they have all kinds of things going on that are naturally occurring in plants. So it's not like anything is neutral. So it's important to understand that GMOs, the objection to GMOs should not start and end with whether or not they're safe for human health. Now, that said, there are some very credible scientists out there that say one of the reasons that people say so confidently that GMOs are not a problem is because we really haven't done enough research on this, that there haven't been enough long-term human feeding studies to find out whether these are problems, that most of the studies that have been done on animals, and humans, despite their similarities to animals, are not actually the same as cows. Now, it's also really important to understand that when we're talking about GMOs, we're also talking about chemicals that are used on the GMOs. So in this country especially, we are growing GMOs to allow them to survive being sprayed by very toxic agricultural chemicals, from the so-called, you know, relatively benign ones like glyphosate, which is known on the market as Roundup, all the way up to much more toxic things like atrazine and whatnot. Now, GMOs are designed, for example, when you farmer and you plant a whole lot of soybeans, you want to spray the crop with herbicides that will kill all the weeds, but it won't kill the soybeans. That's the whole point. So you plant GMO soybeans that you can spray with these chemicals. It'll kill all the weeds, but it won't kill the soybean. So one thing to think about is not just is the GMO soybean a problem for your health, but are the chemicals being sprayed on the soybeans a problem for our health? And that is a totally different question. I mean, whether the GMO is a problem, the chemicals are a problem. And people will argue that things like Roundup or glyphosate are what they call soft or relatively benign chemicals. And that is only true by comparison to other more toxic chemicals. Roundup is, in fact, less dangerous than other chemicals, but that's not to say that it's benign. A fairly important and controversial study was done by the World Health Organization that says that glyphosate is actually what they call a probable human carcinogen, meaning it's not just possible, it's a probable cause of cancer in humans. Now, when you think about Roundup or glyphosate being the most popular, most common herbicide in the world, when we're spraying it on all our food crops, this is something that should give us some pause. I should also mention that a crop that you will think of when you think about GMOs, wheat, is actually not GMO. There is no GMO wheat on the commercial market right now. But ironically. Wheat is often sprayed by farmers with glyphosate as what's known as a desiccant to dry out the seed head right before harvest. There are scientists out there that are beginning to do some research into whether some of these common GI issues that people have, like celiac disease or gluten intolerance and things that they always attribute to an intolerance of wheat, may in fact be a physical reaction to the glyphosate that is sprayed on the wheat. So really, when you're talking about the safety of GMOs, you really ought to be talking about the safety of industrial scale food or agriculture generally, not just single out the GMO as benign. This is what what companies always want to do is say, look, we've proven that GMOs are safe, and they want the conversation to end there. But really, the conversation should include the chemicals that are being used on these crops. I should remind your listeners, in case they don't know, that GMO seeds are often and typically designed by the same companies that make the chemicals. So DuPont, Monsanto, Dow, Syngenta, BASF, Bayer, these giant global chemical companies are in fact the ones that are creating these seeds. And there are cynics out there that say that GMO seeds are really just a vector that allow these big chemical companies to keep selling their chemicals on the big global and agricultural market. So all those things are worth thinking about when we're talking about the relative safety of these things.
You pretty much suggest the evidence shows these big companies are pushing GMOs just to increase profits. And you cite examples in Hawaii on the islands of Maui and Kauai, I believe, where they're doing a lot of testing. And the citizens there have no idea what's going on. Often the government is on the side of the big companies. Is that an accurate portrayal?
Yeah, I think this is a really important thing. And again, I want to emphasize that this book is about GMOs at one level, but really what it's about is about the food industry and about the way companies and government work to basically dictate the way we all eat. I have three chapters in the book about three different islands in Hawaii and their various battles with this question. So on the island of Kauai, which happens to be the westernmost island in the chain of the westernmost state in the United States. In other words, this part of western Kauai is pretty well the end of the road in terms of the United States, right? You can't get any further west than that. And in this little tiny island far out of the public view, some of the biggest global seed and chemical companies in the world are experimenting with these seeds. And so they plant these seeds that have been genetically altered, and then they spray them with these chemicals very intensively and around the calendar, and they're trying to figure out which of the seeds that they're going to take to market, which makes sense for them as a global business model. But there, of course, are actual human beings on the island of Kauai that are objecting to being forced to live right next to these farms where these very intensive uses of these chemicals are being employed. So in Kauai, what local residents did is they went up to the companies and said, would you please tell us what you're spraying on all these experimental crops and tell us what they are and when you're spraying them so we can take precautions? And the company said, we're not going to tell you anything. So the people then went to their elected officials, which on the islands of Hawaii are the county governments. Each island is a county. And they went to the county government and said, would you please go up on our behalf to these companies and ask them to tell us what they're spraying? And the company said, no, we're not going to tell them anything either. So then the people started through a very sort of traditional grassroots political effort. They lobbied their county commission to pass a law that would force these companies to tell them what they were spraying and when and where. And the citizens succeeded. They succeeded in passing a law forcing the companies simply to disclose the herbicides and pesticides that they were spraying. The companies turned around right away when they lost that vote and sued, saying that local county governments are not allowed to dictate the use of the land, that is a federal jurisdiction. So they appealed the case into federal court. And just a couple of months ago, the big companies won their case, which is exactly what's going on in Maui. In Maui, the citizens actually got a huge voter initiative to not only make these companies disclose their information, but they basically voted or were seeking to ban all of these experimental farms from the entire island, and essentially to kick these companies off the island. And the companies were so worried about this bad PR they were getting that they put $9 million. Now, you got to think about $9 million of corporate money into a county initiative on a little island in Hawaii. That is a very, very big deal.
That's a lot.
And they lost. The companies lost that vote. Once again, the voters succeeded, and the companies turned around and sued them in federal court and say, once again, that the federal law trumps the local law. Now, what's really important, and I think the reason I included so much about this in the book, is this seems to me to be a really good example of the way that corporate money and corporate power has a way of running policy. the reason that these companies like to keep all of the food regulation in Washington, that is to say in Congress, is because they can muscle Congress in ways that they can't do in the states or the counties, right? These county governments can beat the companies. State governments can beat the companies in these political battles, but no one can beat these companies when it comes to Washington because they own Congress. This is no secret.
And both parties, we should say.
Both parties. Yes. It's very important to understand that there are no knights on white horses out there. Mm-hmm. You know, these companies are here forever, and the politicians kind of come and go.
They choose Hawaii because of the year-round growing climate, right?
Yeah, it's a perfect climate. They can grow 3 and sometimes even 4 full cycles of crops in a calendar year.
Mm. I was surprised reading the book. I guess I never thought much about industrial farming. I've heard about it, but in our area around here, we mostly see smaller farms, and I've rarely been to the Midwest, so I was a little surprised the extent of it. And you mentioned that almost all the crops now grown are only the corn and the soy.
Yeah, well, yeah. And wheat, although wheat is not GMO, but still it's definitely a part of this whole system. I mean, I have a chapter in there where I describe a road trip that I took with my family where we left from our home in Baltimore and drove all the way across the United States. And I joke that you can fall asleep in Ohio and wake up in Nebraska, and you basically think you have never left the cornfield or the soybean field, depending on where you are. It's like so monochrome. There are something like 200 million acres of GMO corn and soybeans in the United States, and that is a large chunk of land. But, you know, we're not here. We're not devoid of this. If you go down just minutes from here, you start driving down the Eastern Shore, and you will find not enormous farms, but you will find all the farms growing corn and soybeans. And you have to ask, why are all these farmers growing just those two crops? And the answer is because that's what the market wants. It's also important that I make it clear that this book is like in no way somehow anti-farmer. Like this book is, if anything, super pro-farmer. It's just trying to point out that farmers are very good at growing what the market wants. And if the market wants soybeans, that's what they'll grow. If the market wants something else, they'll grow something else. And the way that the American food system has evolved over the last 50 or 60 years is that there is a bottomless appetite for corn and soy. So you have these great, very brilliant farmers all over the country growing whatever the market wants. And if the market wants corn and soy, that's what they'll grow. On the Eastern Shore, we're growing corn and soybeans essentially to feed the chicken industry. Eastern Shore has some of the most beautiful cropland in the United States. It's incredibly fertile land, and we're using it to grow corn and soybeans and chickens. That's what the market wants at the moment, but that does not mean that that is the best use of that land, nor does it say that a diet built on corn, soybeans, and chicken is in any way the best diet. It just happens to be the way that industrial food wants us to be eating right now.
I was a little surprised the extent of soy. For me, I always thought, oh, soy milk, it's popular with vegans. I didn't realize the extent of soy in our diet. It mostly is feed?
Yeah, I mean, something like 40% of all GMOs are used to feed animals, 40%, which is a very large number. So if you're eating anything that is made out of chicken, that you're eating indirectly soy. If you're eating anything that's made out of beef, you're eating corn. I mean, Michael Pollan, who wrote The Omnivore's Dilemma, says we like to think of ourselves as milk-fed Americans or beef-fed Americans. What we really are is corn-fed Americans, because what we're eating is corn and also, of course, soybeans. So that's the fundamental building block of our diet.
And you're listening to Campus Voices here at 91.3 WVUD. Our guest today is Professor McKay Jenkins of UD's English Department, talking about his latest book, Food Fight, GMOs in the American Diet. Well, let's mention something more on the positive side, going back to Hawaii's Big Island. What about the papaya?
Yeah, great question. So as I mentioned, there are 3 chapters about GMOs, 2 Maui and Kauai, examples of people fighting against GMOs. And the Big Island is a place where there's a great case study of a very positive use of this technology. The Big Island, traditionally, like Oahu, was a place where Hawaiian farmers grew papaya. Papaya is a very big crop in Hawaii, and they eat it, and they also export it. And there's something known as the Hawaiian ring spot virus that started to contaminate these trees and made them essentially unmarketable. When it attacks the fruit, the skin on the papaya looks very kind of like a leper. It's all kind of mottled and doesn't look at all attractive. And once a virus affects the papaya, they can't sell it. So this virus in the 1950s had wiped out the papaya plantations on Oahu. And now in the 1980s, it was starting to attack the plantations in Big Island. So these farmers in desperation turn to what turns out, by lucky coincidence, a local native-born Hawaiian plant scientist who happened to be on the faculty at Cornell University, and they said to him, our papaya plantation is going to go down in flames unless you can help us figure out a way to build in some kind of resistance to this virus. And Dennis Gonzalez, this guy's name is, he went into the laboratory and figured out a way to build in resistance using genetic engineering to make the papaya resistant to this ring spot virus. And it was very successful. And in just a very few short years, the papaya crop rebounded beautifully and now is a very vibrant part of the Big Island's economy. It's really worth mentioning, though, that the research done into the ring spot virus GMO was purely done by nonprofit university researchers, which, again, to my mind, is continuing to kind of repeat this refrain, which is that the GMO technology in the hands of people who are not doing it for profit but are doing it for the benefit of either farmers or consumers is a perfectly logical use of this technology. It's when the technology is used to crank out billions of animals fed on this stuff or billions of pounds of cheap and low nutrition food, that is a problem. So the technology is not the issue. The issue is how the technology is used.
So you may even get some pushback from some anti-GMO people who read this book because you're not really saying it's all bad or
no,
it's all good.
Anytime anybody writes about GMOs, you're going to get pushback from all corners. I did my best in this book to walk the line between all this and try to figure out who has a logical and convincing argument and who is just screaming. I mean, the thing about GMOs is that you get on the internet and look them up and you will find not only utterly contradictory information, because you'll find one website that says GMOs are evil and one website that says that the thing that's going to save all of us. And all of these things are so one-sided that you can't make any sense of it. So this book really does a very concerted effort to balance all of these different points of view and try to figure out the best way to walk through it all.
If there was something that summed up the moral of your book at the end, I'm just going to read a quick quote from you. Perhaps beyond advances in science and engineering, we need to remember our own traditions of growing and eating food. There was a time from 10,000 years ago until just a couple of generations ago when we managed to feed ourselves from a wide variety of plants and animals without the aid of huge companies and without laying waste to our land and our communities. No matter what else you say about the way we eat today, one thing is clear. We eat differently from how any other people in the history of the world have eaten.
So the way we eat now, which is eating the byproducts of an industrial food system, is a brand new phenomenon. And it is, I've been talking about health and nutrition, but the damage that this style of agriculture is doing to our soil, which is dramatically degraded, to our water, which is dramatically degraded, to our species, which is dramatically degraded. If you think about using, for example, herbicides on all these millions of acres of crops, they're killing all the weeds. And one of the weeds they're killing is milkweed, which is the primary food source for monarch butterflies, which are in dramatic decline. I mean, monarch butterfly populations right now are around 4% of what they used to be. That is a very clear byproduct of industrial scale agriculture. So in other words, we are basically sacrificing our soil, our water, our species diversity, our forests, all kinds of different native plants. Agriculture at an industrial scale is also one of the primary drivers of climate change. So we're making all these huge sacrifices all so that we can eat lots and lots and lots of low nutrition, high calorie food, which is a unique thing. Even, I mean, it's not even unique historically, it's even unique in the world now. Like, we eat differently than Europeans eat, than Asians eat, than Latin Americans eat. We've thrown all our lot in with this giant industrial food system. It's just not good for anything. It's not good for our bodies. It's not good for the land. It's not good for the water. It's not good for the animals. It's not good for the birds. So this is why this book is about way more than just GMOs. It's really about having a little bit of self-awareness about what our behavior is doing to the whole picture, to our bodies and the environment as a whole.
And you have examples where students have really had a shift in attitude from the farming. You have them participate in with your classes. You have a quote from a student named Danielle saying, the feeling that I get every time when I went to the farm is unexplainable. The satisfaction that I now have when I take a bite out of an organic tomato is something that I would never experience if I didn't take this class.
So my idea of getting even English majors to go work on a farm is to not just to get them to grow food, that's a nice byproduct, but is really to reconnect them to the whole process, the whole idea of being a human being on the actual land and understanding what it means, the connection between weather and soil and plants and animals and trying to understand insects. All these things work together and we need to know more about these things, not less, which is one, I think, one downside of the whole obsession we have with science, which is that somehow we think that scientists are going to solve our food problem. We need to solve the food problem, not scientists. Like, we need, as a collective community, we need to understand more about what's going on. If we did that, I think we'd overcome a lot of these problems.
I was intrigued that you even mentioned some city farms cropping up, such as in Baltimore.
Yeah. I mean, if you think about the traditional urban dweller, it's one thing to live in the suburbs and at least see some trees and some open space. If you live in the city, you don't even see that. So in a lot of these gutted former industrial cities like my own beloved Baltimore or Detroit, I think in the last 30 or 40 years, they say has lost 700,000 people. 700,000 people used to live in that city and no longer do. So what that has meant is this incredible hemorrhaging of people and money and everything else out of these cities. So the cities are basically collapsing on the inside. What happens is they bulldoze these buildings. Now you have all these empty lots, and they're regenerating by having all these creative people move in. Often weirdly, I know personally a whole bunch of people that were trained in art school that have decided to become farmers inside cities because they're using incredible creative ingenuity to do things like grow food for local communities. So you're reusing the land in these cities. And of course, like one of the most undernourished subsections of the population are people who live in cities that have no access to supermarkets. So if your only place to buy food is a corner store or a McDonald's, you're not really getting a lot of access to good produce. Whether it's organic or not is not even really the question, just getting produce at all. So what you find in lots of urban environments like Baltimore and Detroit, Philadelphia, Chicago, Milwaukee, you see a lot of really exciting urban farming initiatives going on, not just in the land, but also you're starting to see things like vertical farming, rooftop farming, all this sort of thing. So a lot of the ingenuity now is coming out of these cities. And I should also say an interesting thing that in my environmental humanities classes, I kept waiting for 15 years. I kept waiting to hear that some of my students were going to go in to become farmers. Like for many decades, people were coming to the university from farming families, somehow desperate to do anything except farming. And I think one of the reasons for that is that they lost the enthusiasm for growing corn and soybeans. Like that just didn't interest them. Mm-hmm. What's happening now, like every year now, I'm finding English majors are deciding that they spent a year abroad working on a farm, or they did what's called woofing, where they worked on an organic farm somewhere around the world. And now they want to come back and become farmers, but not industrial farmers. What they want to do is do a really interesting local produce farm or a dairy farm or poultry farm, whatever it is, and raise animals or produce in a way that is sustainable and small scale and built in the center of a community, not just full pump more stuff into the industrial system, but to keep it local and become part of a larger community.
And how about even reviving the good old backyard garden?
Yeah, I mean, I know lots of people, environmental activists and those kinds of folks that say you could teach somebody a whole lot about environmental work just by having them plant a single tomato and tend it from seed until fruit's out.
Well, I got to ask this. Did writing this book alter any of your eating habits?
Yeah, I would say it made me even firmer in my determination not to give certain companies my money. Like when I'm going to the supermarket, I can necessarily mention them here, but I like if I'm walking through the meat section, we don't eat a whole lot of meat. But if we ever do, there are certain companies whose label is on the product that that simply will not ever get my money because I know how they function in the world. I also am now kind of hyper aware about the famous middle of the supermarket, which is where you find all this stuff. Now, it's worth mentioning that whether you're interested in or obsessed with GMOs or not, and people always want to know how to eat better, well, the strategy for avoiding GMOs is the same strategy for eating well generally, which is to stay away from the middle of the supermarket, right? You want to spend your time in the produce aisle, where you get lots of fresh fruits and vegetables, which almost by definition are not GMO, and you know, eat your dairy and eat your breads and things like that, but stay away from the processed food and the junk food. Now, you will find GMOs in some kinds of dairy products because the cattle are all eating GMOs, which is yet another reason I should mention to eat organic. If you're gonna eat anything organic, the thing to eat organic is the dairy stuff. Eat organic milk and organic cheese.
Well, I think we've run out of time, so thank you for being here today. Again, we've been talking with Professor McKay Jenkins about his latest book, Food Fight, GMOs and the Future of the American Diet. Thank you for being with Campus Voices today.
Thanks for the invitation.
Thanks for listening to Campus Voices. The views expressed on this program are those of the individual participants and do not necessarily reflect the official views of WVUD or the University of Delaware. For more information about Campus Voices and to find archived episodes, visit our website, www.udel.edu/campusvoices. We invite you to tune in every Thursday morning at 8:30 for Campus Voices on 91.3 FM, WVUD, and WVUD HD1, Newark, or online at wvud.org.